This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. To learn more, visit RT11.com.
This week, Meat and Three is taking you to market and all over the world, from Newfoundland to Tunisia.
Well, a lot of us think of, you know, the British Empire trading things like spices and sugar and silk. But you write that it actually began with salt cod from Newfoundland.
There was a port closure in Tunisia, which was horrible. I mean, it was months, boats just sitting on the water waiting to go, and they couldn't go anywhere.
And we'll learn about how markets have changed, whether because of their customers or the climate.
A few years ago, something around 10 years, it was totally different.
It almost manifests itself to almost smelling like an old fire pit. When you, mm-hmm. when you put it out, it has that sort of charcoal-y smell to it. It's not good for wine.
Join us this week on Meat and Three for our global market tour. And don't forget to subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robin.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
If our main function is, you know, for our audience is to give them a sense of time and place, right? Is to get them a better understanding of where they are in the season. And maybe there's these little moments of overlap that inspires a dish. Let's say we want to serve that and tell that story. Sometimes taking a real careful approach to how you present it is mm-hmm. important. And the way that those items align on the plate or the direction in which you can guide them to eat them or enjoy them is important, right? And
mm-hmm.
and we take a lot of care into that to really help tell that story.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it's, you know, about a moment in time. Sometimes it's a very specific, you know, group of plants that might be growing together and doing mm-hmm. interacting in an interesting way.
Or mm-hmm.
you know, it doesn't matter. It's like just about the story.
That is Chef Jamie Simpson of the Culinary Vegetable Institute at the Chef's Garden, our guest this week on Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's gonna take a Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, and I am really excited to introduce you to this week's guest. And by the way, I should say, I am here solo, as has been happening with some frequency this summer. And regular listeners know that that means not a lot of chit-chat. Going to get right to the point. Going to introduce you to this week's guest. Our primary guest, I should say, because we have quite a fun segment on the second half of the show, but our guest of the week is Jamie Simpson. Jamie has been the chef liaison and executive chef of the Culinary Vegetable Institute at the Chef's Garden in Milan, Ohio, for the last 6 years. Now, a lot of you may not have heard of the Culinary Vegetable Institute, but I would imagine many of you have heard of the Chef's Garden. It is a family-owned farm that for about, gosh, I guess I'd say 36 years has been specializing in providing specialty and high-quality produce to chefs around the world. And the family member who's sort of charged with spreading the word about the Chef's Garden is Lee Jones, also known as Farmer Lee Jones. And for those of you who don't know him by name, I'm sure you have seen him about. He's a regular fixture at industry events. He is usually attired in blue overalls, a white dress shirt, and a red bow tie. I think a lot of you, when I just listed all those descriptors, said, oh, I know that guy. Well, that is Lee Jones. There are several other family members involved in the farm. It wasn't always devoted to chef's needs. It was what you would call a commercial farm until the early 80s. I can't spend the time this week to get into it, but there was a crossroads the family found themselves at. And as the American chef movement was really starting to ratchet up, they decided to commit themselves to providing what this growing population of chefs in the United States was looking for, you know, ingredients that would help them realize these dishes that they had in mind. to the best of their abilities. As you know, you can't cook great food without great ingredients. The Chef's Garden has now spread its wings. It provides food all over the world via quite an impressive shipping operation that I had a chance to tour. And on the property, or I should say just down the road, is the Culinary Vegetable Institute, which is part of the Chef's Garden. And that is there's a beautiful kitchen there. There is an event space there. And Jamie Simpson is the chef of that property. He has been there for 6 years, as I said. He serves as the chef liaison for visiting chefs for events, and also executive chef of the Culinary Vegetable Institute. He also, along with Lee, is a bit of a spokesperson. You may have met Jamie if you're in the industry at events around the country. He's a young guy. He's very well spoken. He's incredibly thoughtful. He seems utterly devoid of an ego, although he's remarkably talented. You know, his job demands of him that he adapt to the styles of different visiting chefs or function in a way that allows dishes that he puts together to coexist with dishes that one or more visiting chefs might do as part of, say, a tasting menu. That was the case in June when the Chef's Garden was kind enough to host me. They put on a totally 80s dinner in honor of my book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. A couple of chefs were kind enough to donate their time. David Waltuck of the late, great Chanterelle Restaurant in New York City, a good friend of mine, came in to do a course. Claudia Fleming, who most of you probably know that name, was the pastry chef for years of Gramercy Tavern and currently operates the North Fork Table and Inn in Long Island, New York. They both came out. Claudia did the dessert. The other three courses of the evenings were created by Jamie. Jamie did a dish based on the style of Alice Waters. He did a dish based on the style of the late Jean-Louis Paladin. And he did a Southwestern dish, probably most closely inspired by an L.A. chef some people may remember named John Sedler. And those were all three compositions that he came up with just for this one event, which is one of several events that Jamie might do in a given month. And I have to say, he hit the books. He kind of absorbed what all those people were about, what the era was about, and his food very comfortably stood shoulder to shoulder with the food that David and Claudia did. That is, to me, quite impressive. Anyway, I wanted you all to meet Jamie because he is somebody I've known for several years. I've always just really enjoyed him, and I think you're going to love meeting him. I think you're going to love hearing about what it's like to operate in a place as unique as the Chef's Garden. And to see somebody who's really kind of, you know, gone their own way and become quite happy doing it. I should also mention, because you'll hear us allude to it, I had no idea this was the case, but when we were looking for a place to do the interview on the day after the dinner, kind of wedged between when we all woke up that morning and when I had to get on a plane back to New York, Jamie offered a coffee shop as a venue. I did not realize that he actually owns the coffee shop, which is something he'll explain in the opening moments of this interview. Anyway, I think that's all you need to know about it. I think you're going to love this guy. He's somebody I love running into at events and on the road and visiting at the Chef's Garden, which this is, I think, my third visit there. And I hope to make another one soon. And Jamie, if you're listening, I'm kind of secretly, as I was editing this interview, thinking I might want to come work there for a week or two at some point. Would you let me do that? I'll look forward to your text about that. And one of the things that made me want to work there is I got to spend all this time with Jamie's kitchen team. And the second segment of this week's show is I sat down right after my interview with Jamie on that Sunday morning with the four principal members of his kitchen team at the Culinary Vegetable Institute. There are people who've been there, some of them only for a few weeks, some of them for a couple of years. They there's quite an age span amongst them, and they're all there for very different reasons. And I think it's a real opportunity to hear from some people who have kind of made a unique decision about how to spend some of their professional time. And I think for any of you out there who are young cooks, it's a really valuable lesson in just going with your gut and doing what feels right with the time you spend developing your career. But I'll introduce that more properly in the middle of the show. For now, here is my interview with executive chef and culinary liaison of the Culinary Vegetable Institute, Jamie Simpson. Here you go. What is the deal now? You have this big job at the Culinary Vegetable Institute. You've had it for 6 years?
Correct, yeah.
Okay. And then
we count our years in seasons. So it's actually 4 seasons times 6. How many is
that's
that?
That's 24, which is my lucky number, actually.
That's how many seasons? Yeah. 23 and a half seasons.
Okay. Do you get an employee review every season?
No. Yeah, well, sort of, yeah.
No. So listen, so we're hanging around the other day, and we're trying to figure out where to do this interview, and then you say to me, well, we could go to the coffee shop, and then you're describing this place with multiple private rooms and stuff, and then at some point you slip in that you own the coffee shop.
No, you said, do you know the owner or something?
Yeah. Yes. And you said yes, and it's you.
Well, it's me and my girlfriend.
And Morgan. Your girlfriend. Yes. So, but what's the story with, what's the deal with this? How do you even have time with that? We're going to talk about what your job entails, but how do you even have time to even think about another
thing?
Did
you not always dream of living above a coffee shop?
I've dreamed of living in a hotel.
Cool.
With the ability to order room service and a maid that would come up every, you know, like in an old movie when people live in hotels in New York. Yes. And if I'm honest, I actually still sort of think that would be really amazing. Really, really amazing. But no, I never dreamed of having like the mom and pop situation, like being above the restaurant and all that.
When I first moved to Huron, Ohio, mm-hmm. 6 years ago to work at the Chef's Garden, I temporarily lived in the basement of Farmer Lee Jones
mm-hmm.
for what temporarily became 18 months.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. During that time, I was shopping for a place to live. And
yeah.
This is one of the places I came to, the coffee house. In town, it's this cultural icon, this staple that the mayor comes twice a day. You know, the SWAT team practices here.
The SWAT team practices
yeah,
here?
Yeah, they like run through drills in the conference rooms and they like, they work. And the
not during service.
The fire chiefs here. The police
unless they're chief, working on hostage negotiation.
The director just walked by. You know, like everybody's right. in this town. And,
okay.
It's important that to me, I have a window into the community. And mm-hmm. the Culinary Vegetable Institute, we're only open to the public once a month.
Okay.
So I felt disconnected from my neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, 6 years ago, this building, I came here and I came up to the cashier for some coffee, and I asked, are there apartments for rent upstairs? It's a big building.
I wasn't really, it's Sunday morning. I'm catatonic. I wasn't being observant. How tall is the building?
We'll go through. It's a three story.
Okay.
You know,
got it.
12,000 square foot, late 1800s brick
yeah.
beast.
Yeah.
And they said, the cashier said, no, I'm sorry, sir. The owners live up there. And it's like, So fast forward 4 or 5 years, I'm out of Lee's basement. I'm in a farmhouse in town. And I finally met the owners.
Okay.
They're wonderful people.
Uh-huh.
And it happened to be that they were just working out into the next chapter of their life.
The exit plan.
Yep.
The
sixth of six adopted kids have gone off to college. And they're ready for the next. And they said, would you like to live above the coffee shop?
Mm-hmm.
And we said, yes. So it's a side project, but how do you have time? I think time is a state of mind. Honestly, I think mm-hmm. time is as valuable as you choose to make it.
Yeah.
And you know that, I mean, you're everywhere, right? Like I am,
but I was going to say, come back to me after you have kids because I'm everywhere now, but my kids are also, you know, about 15, so they don't need much looking after.
Yeah.
But I could never have been as well traveled as I currently am 10 years ago.
We've got a kid. She's right here. She's laying down.
What's
this
dog's name again?
Nilla.
Nilla. Yeah. What kind of is she a mixed breed?
A golden retriever.
She's a golden retriever.
Yeah, one of Farmer Lee Jones.
But she's like. But wait a minute. Yeah, she seems more like a bleached out golden retriever.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, she's beautiful.
Totally 80s. Rock and roll.
I got to be honest. I usually do a lot of reading up on people before I come to these interviews. We were going to meet today around 10. I'm like, There's no reason for me to. I didn't even set my alarm, which is unusual. But, you know, yesterday I woke up at 6:15, I think, my first day, morning here. I slept till, I had one of these, like, country, city people comes to the country things. Like, I slept till 8:30 this morning and still did, like, could barely get out of bed. I was just so in another place mentally. So I'm coming to this a little, I mean, I know stuff about you, but not as well briefed as I normally would. But take me through it. Are you originally from Charleston? Where were you born?
Born and raised in Charleston, South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
25 years there, essentially, called
yeah.
me at home.
Yeah.
Worked for a hotel group called the Orient Express.
Uh-huh.
The hotel specifically was the Charleston Place Hotel and the restaurant, the Charleston Grill, which mm-hmm. was a Bob Wagner,
okay.
Michelle Weaver.
Yeah.
Mickey Baxt, some like mm-hmm. really, just really great stewards of hospitality that mm-hmm. operated that
mm-hmm.
that place. And with the hotel group, I was able to work among the other 52 properties globally for a stint, and spent 3 years in 9 countries. And it was a life-changing experience to go and work in bucket list destinations, not just to go visit them, but to like be a part of them.
To be there yeah. long enough that I've always felt this way about foreign countries or even just another state in yeah. the, or city. You really get it. You really get it at a almost like granular level when you're there long enough that you're just there, like yeah. you're living there. Sure. You're reading books. You're watching the news. You have a daily routine. That's different from spending 5 days somewhere.
Right.
That's what you mean.
When you have a dream with those languages in them, you know.
Oh, that's good.
Like those kinds of.
You would actually dream in other languages?
Well, I have a lot of trouble, like, you know, picking up other languages and
yeah.
other countries, but kitchen seems to be this universal space, right? Like in any kitchen globally, you can.
Because it's a finite vocabulary.
You can communicate,
yeah.
right? And there's.
I want to get back to your earlier life, even though before we finish this thing. But tell me, like, so what? Where are we talking? Where'd you go, and for how long?
Yeah, Le Manoir at Raymond Blanc's, 2 weeks.
So that's in the countryside outside of London,
Oxford.
Yeah,
yeah. In the
is it Oxford, or Oxfordshire,
Oxford.
Yeah,
we did Lima, which was the Miraflores Park Hotel.
Okay,
the Hiram Bingham train up. And that's another Orient Express train that goes up to Machu Picchu.
Oh, my gosh.
On Machu Picchu, there's one hotel, and it's essentially, it's also Orient Express property, was Orient Express
yeah.
property, and it's called the Machu Picchu Lodge. It's like a truck stop with an orchid garden, but beautiful venue.
Yeah, yeah, you know? Yeah.
And a total of 2 weeks in Peru on that. And we did, again, there's 52 properties. So at one time there was a collection, there was a group of people kind of navigating the entire hotel group, through a culinary program, really trying to bring the organization together
mm-hmm.
as one.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could imagine that kind of accounting nightmare of hotels like that all over the world,
all the conversions and all the, company. Yeah, right.
Wow. What brought me here, and I think this is my most favorite bridge, is continuing to see the Chef's Garden vegetables in all of these places.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you're all over. Why is the world's largest exporter of produce, Peru, importing vegetables from Milan, Ohio?
Uh-huh.
That's a bigger question.
Yeah.
You know, why and how can you go somewhere where you really, truly feel like you're in a different place, but have that singular touch that's like a, you know, it could be like a little package of micro chives, you know, from the Chef's Garden,
mm-hmm.
Stored not with the rest of the produce, but, you know, on its own shelf, on its own pedestal,
mm-hmm.
in its own place. And I just developed a real reverence for the farm, the Chef's Garden, through working in these places.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came back to Charleston, really focused and decided to, you know, made a clear intention to come up to the Chef's Garden.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote Farmer a letter. He just said something about it last night. He said, "Hey, I found that letter."
Oh God, I love moments like that. Yeah.
I have no clue what it said, but I'd love to see it. Anyway, And I came up here for a project.
You wrote him an actual letter.
Yeah.
Dropped it in the mail.
Yeah.
Okay.
Don't you? Don't you do that in the world of...
Usually somebody has to have died, but yes, once in a while. Yeah.
Yeah, you should get back to that.
Not for
communication.
Yeah. People kept telling me I made me seem old to do that.
So I came up here first for a 4-month project called Roots Conference.
Yes.
It was the first one the farm had done. Lee asked, he said, look, I've got a project for you. If you want, you can help. It'll take about 4 months to organize it and get it together. So I came up in August and was planning to leave, 4 months later and never left.
Never left.
Yeah.
Well, we should say for people who don't know, a lot of people don't know, right? Like I'll say to people, I'm going up to the Chef's Garden to do this event. Oh, what's that? I'm like, And they're like, no, I don't. I go, yeah, this Lee Jones. No, I go, you see him at the events, the overalls, the bow tie, guy. Yeah, right. And then they get it. I mean, at least it's something. I mean, it's a frame of reference. The system works.
Right.
Yeah, the system works. Before we get into all this, can we just talk a little bit about your life before the kitchen in Charleston?
Music.
Music?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, first of all, what kind of kid were you? You seemed like a very quietly confident person. Was that sort of your demeanor, like, all through life?
I think I was quiet, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Confidence came, like, in trust, with people that I knew. It didn't come really to strangers naturally.
So you sort of tiptoe into new situations, and then once you get comfortable so if it's a group of people that you feel safe with, then you click into a different...
Yeah.
What's funny? That's me. I'm the same way. Yeah. Yeah, I totally get that. You don't believe in small talk. You don't particularly like it.
Not really.
Yeah.
And with a big group, like if we're in I'm just only putting myself in that classroom setting. I might be sitting by the person who's teaching, and just that's it.
Right.
You might gravitate towards a group of people and then confidence comes later.
This is a good litmus test question. You will or will not go to a party alone?
I will.
Oh, you will?
Yeah.
Okay.
I will.
Okay.
I will. Not really I'll do that.
You're comfortable. I should say it another way. You will or will not go to a party where you don't necessarily know anybody alone?
I think I might.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Is that an evolution?
Definitely. Yes. So if we're playing like
you just lost the newlywed game because over your shoulder, I'm getting a head shake saying no.
So here's the deal. Here's the deal. And this is like, I was able to then like play music in a band and I think it was something that was a big leap for me. It was a big thing to get on stage and, and perform and like try and sing or try and do something. It was really not my thing, but that group of people that I became friends with were in a band and they asked me to come over and play. And before I was 21, we had played 40 states in the United States.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay. This wasn't just like a garage band.
Yeah,
you guys
it was
were
like a garage band.
No, but you were,
we worked in a studio and,
but you were touring.
Yeah.
What did you play?
I played bass on stage and then just various fill-in instruments in the studio.
And you were lead singer or everybody kind of sang?
No, there was a lead singer and a,
but you were, so you would do backup?
I would, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Did you ever do solo? Did you ever?
No.
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 Okay.
Come on. That'd be crazy.
What was the name of the band?
Steve Hit Mike was the touring band.
Steve Hit Mike?
Yeah.
Okay, was there an incident that?
Yeah, there was.
Okay,
you're a man of Google. Look it up.
Okay, so, wow. Okay,
so it was a fun
Brought you out a little bit.
It brought me out, and in any way, I think it really gave me a lot of confidence in the kitchen. I was cooking in a barbecue restaurant during this time period. At 14, I started cutting ribs and pulling pork.
Was that just for money, or did you think you might want to go
totally
into cooking?
For money.
Okay.
Yeah. I was good at it, and I liked it. And I always reference this one thing, like, I'd never seen a piping bag before, but they would put, like, these sour cream and these reusable piping bags.
Yeah.
And you could, with a star tip,
Yeah.
You could do the thing, you know, that sour cream thing.
The fancy thing. Yeah.
I never saw anything like that and was really drawn to it, and cutting chives. I never knew how to make those little green round dots.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 14, but I didn't come from a family of cooks or anything. I came from two working parents that, you know, put food down.
Yes.
More so we could sit together.
Yes. You know? So what was sort of the moment where you thought you might want to, did you think you were going to, I mean, you were in a touring band. Did you think for a time that might be what you did for a living? Did you think you were going to be like a traveling musician?
For a time, yes, until you're actually doing it. And I felt this is unsustainable. A full, complete, 100% feeling that I cannot live for many years.
Was it the physical exhaustion? Was it the kind of rootless feeling of being in a hotel and living out of a suitcase?
Oh, come on. We didn't have hotels. We had a tour van, and
you slept in the van.
We had houses that.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, that's what it was like. Okay.
Yeah.
And what are you saying? Oh, come on! I don't know about. I don't write about musicians. I write about cooks.
Yeah. Hotels.
Okay.
Right. No, it was the, you know, it was a, it's just a hard lifestyle. You're living in bars and random venues and sleeping on couches and it's just tough, man.
All right. And so you had been cooking, and then was that kind of growing in your sort of affection as sort of the life on the road was sort of, it like a seesaw where one side was going down and the other side was coming up?
Kind of. They're kind of the same side. If you could imagine that same sort of creative, like, opportunities to, like, you know, and when you're on tour, you get to like play that same song, right? And like when you're in a restaurant, you get to do that too. And every once in a while, a new song pops up in a restaurant,
right. Or you can jam, or you can riff,
you can try new menus, or there's a thing. And I really enjoyed that parallel for a long time. Really focused on that, the parallels between, you know, cooking in a kitchen or working in a restaurant or eating a dish, even to, like, you know, those in music and how those playing in a band or working in a studio or playing a song, you know, kind of felt the same.
Mm-hmm.
On a granular level and a very large, like, overhead view,
mm-hmm.
very similar. I really loved it. I loved cooking. I got a job at the hotel. I lied, you know, almost my way through this interview. I remember the guy asked me for, you know, what about fennel and things like that I had never had or heard of. And this is 15 years ago, and it was 18 years ago. And it wasn't, you know, I got the job.
What was the fennel thing?
I don't know. It was like, you know.
He asked you about fennel
like,
and.
What do you do with fennel or something like that?
And what did you say?
You make a salad or something, you know. I don't know.
But you didn't really know. You didn't know what it was.
Yeah, it just wasn't a.
Uh huh.
Wasn't a thing for a touring musician.
Yeah. You know? Now you strike me. I don't know. As I have sized you up from spending time with you, you strike me as a fairly honest person. You, when you describe lying your way through an interview, was that conflicting for you inside?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think the word lying is appropriate. I think
fudged.
I put on my best, you know, to right. get through this interview
Got
and do
it.
A good job.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Okay. And, okay.
You know, there was that.
Okay. So when you decide you're going to switch gears, what did you have a sense of what that was going to look like? Did you...
Yes.
have a sense of what kind of chef ultimately maybe you wanted to be or what kind of food you wanted to cook? What was that like when you looked down that path? What did you see for yourself?
First of all, I think I really wanted to, I wanted to grow very quickly. I felt like I was behind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at this point I'm like, maybe I'm 20 or 19. And mm-hmm. I felt like I was behind the other cooks that were in the...
Probably true for your generation, because people were starting younger than they used to.
Right.
Yeah.
But fortunately for me, I had lived in bars for the last, you know, 5 years and was kind of over that scene. So was able to go home and read. Or go to the library and find books.
Yeah,
and it was a really, really powerful decade.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in that time where And it was Charleston, South Carolina, right? There's 400 restaurants on a 4-square-mile peninsula. So the ability to go out and learn something every single day was very
powerful. It was a very powerful, exciting time to be
there.
It was
a very good time, It was a lot of growth and a lot of things happening. And we were, I mean, everybody was you know, busy.
Learning.
It was really good.
Let's come back to your role here, right? You know, yesterday we were here for this event, and you called me and said, "Where are you?" And I said, "I'm upstairs." And you said, "You want to see something you'll never forget?"
Yeah.
And you took me out, and I watched you. This is on my personal Instagram feed if anybody wants to see it. But I watched you. I have a mental block on the term catch a swarm of bees. You started the beekeeping program here about 5 years ago,
right?
And I watched you, there was a hive on a branch of a tree. I watched you clear the branches around it, get up on a ladder, take a saw, saw the end of the branch off from the tree, go over to the box where you put I don't know what you call the box. Isn't that also a hive? Yeah. Shake the bees into the hive. Amazingly, at one point, as you're doing this with your beekeeper, you know, mesh hat on and everything, you go, and I was filming it, you go, "Give me your camera."
Yeah. Did you see it?
And then, I put it on Instagram. And then you held the camera over the hive, and then you handed it back to me. I didn't have any gear on.
Right.
So then you can see my shadow on the ground, like trying to like wave all the bees off me. So anyway, it was something to watch. Okay, that's just like one thing you do here, and it's not even in the kitchen, right? So can you just talk, just as you would define it to somebody, what's the scope of your job here?
In a single sentence, our goals are to really get a better understanding of where our foods come from.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In general, and then how a small sustainable ecosystem happens,
mm-hmm.
Whether that's an old farmhouse in the middle of the country, with some people living on it and working on it. Or whether it's a business that sells events to customers.
Yeah.
It's sort of the same. So our goals are, in a single sentence, get a real, true, honest understanding of where our food comes from.
Mm-hmm.
I've learned by coming here that, obviously, that every part of a plant's life offers something unique to the plate, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the Chef's Garden motto. That's the thing that inspires them to pick different things at different stages and things. Doing that and looking at everything like that,
mm-hmm.
Let's say it's beekeeping, or let's say it's, let's say you just want to make, you could start by asking the right questions. Back in the day when we started really pushing at the Culinary Vegetable Institute, it started with the garbage can from the beginning. You know, there was only a dumpster. There was only one place to put waste, and
mm-hmm.
that was a dumpster. There
mm-hmm.
was not, there were not jars of pickles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were not chickens to eat compost. There wasn't a compost pile per se
mm-hmm.
at the institute, at the kitchen. There wasn't recycle. You know, there was just real simple mm-hmm. steps, and we decided to start dividing this stuff and making homes for them. So, you know, it first came the chickens, which is a natural balance to things, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you have like lettuce trim or outer leaves, if you're washing, like you give them to the chickens, and guess what? They give you eggs,
mm-hmm.
you know, and sometimes they give you an extra rooster, you mm-hmm. know, that you might cook. Real simple,
mm-hmm.
right? And then we got busier and we started doing more events, and we generate, obviously by nature, you generate more overage. You generate more lettuce. You
mm-hmm.
generate more tomato scraps or something like that. And so we got pigs. And as a byproduct of that, occasionally you get a couple hams.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So then where do you put the hams? You put the mm-hmm. hams in a root cellar. You,
mm-hmm.
you make some place that you can hang these things. And now you have this place. What else can you put in here? Right? Let's start everything, right? And
mm-hmm.
pickles and jams and jellies and just preservation as a whole has become a massive, massive part of our day-to-day.
Mm-hmm.
With the bees, naturally you want beehives on your farm,
mm-hmm.
right? We've discovered more fruit trees on our property I never knew we had
mm-hmm.
before the bees.
Mm-hmm.
By having bees, now I know there's massive cherry trees all over the property, you know, and that you just didn't see them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe they weren't pollinated.
Now, everything you're describing is, because none of this is what I think of all this as sort of the, not ancillary, but if I was going to tier what I perceive your role as here, that would be second tier. All this would be second tier stuff to me.
I would agree.
And the first tier stuff would be you're the chef of the Culinary Vegetable Institute. You serve as, I guess, a liaison or collaborator with visiting chefs.
Correct.
You cook things with the food produced by the Chef's Garden. Mm-hmm. You're out there on the road more and more. I've seen you at festivals and conferences, and we've been to some of the same ones.
Yeah.
So you're sort of a representative or an ambassador for the place. Those are the things for me, from the outside looking in, seem like tier one.
Yeah.
Accurate?
Yeah, I think so. I think from the outside looking in, that's accurate.
Okay.
From the inside looking out, I mean, you can very easily get busy in the day-to-day of things.
Yeah.
Fortunately, by doing these things, people have interest in them. You know, mm-hmm. chefs really also want to know where their food comes from.
Yeah.
You know,
oh my
truly,
gosh, sure.
Right? Like truly.
Yes.
Not like who's growing it, but like how's it grown? Where is it grown? At what depth or what part of the field is it grown? You know,
yeah, I mean, to different degrees. I mean, there are people who are absolutely, I mean, could probably give you a run for your money. Right. Like I think of somebody like Lawrence Jostle at Nopa mm-hmm. Restaurant.
Okay.
Have you met him?
No.
I mean, he won't drink coffee if he doesn't know where it comes from.
Okay.
You know, we did an event together way up in, you know, a couple hours north of San Francisco where he's based. He brought his own coffee beans because mm-hmm. he wasn't going to drink the coffee like at the hotel.
Yeah, we do that. We bring our own coffee
beans. Do you?
Yeah. You can't always rely on hotel coffee.
Okay. That's a pretty, if you're going to have a little barometer, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Most people don't do that.
Yeah. Sometimes you can, but I'm okay with that.
Okay.
You know,
if you're really serious, you'd also bring your own water.
Right. Here's the deal. You know, our customers in general, customers in the dining room, they're better too. Like they're more savvy.
Oh, sure.
They're pushing our chefs, I think.
Yeah.
Too.
But so talk to me about the culinary part of it.
Yeah. So in the kitchen specifically, we host guest chefs, let's say for menu development.
Mm-hmm.
If a group is about to open something exciting and they just need a place to bring their team and test drive some things, we'll facilitate for that. The kitchen's gorgeous.
It's great.
Built 20 years ago next year.
It looks like it was put together last week. I mean, it's right. Like, yeah, you guys really take care of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The board of directors on the opening end of that was just a, you know, rock star list of
mm-hmm.
Keller and Dukas and Danielle and Chris Hastings and mm-hmm. some really cool Tremonto and
mm-hmm.
just a lot of just a good Charlie Trotter was a huge influence on the build and design of
mm-hmm.
it. So if you've ever been to Charlie Trotter's kitchen, you'll see a lot of it in the culinary.
Oh, that's interesting. Too. I had been in that. I never thought of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So he started the like built in low boys where they're not on like wheels or legs, but they're actually tiled in. And
yes.
Up.
Yes.
So there's no sweeping under,
yes.
or, you know, any of that stuff. And so all the equipment is mostly really built into the ground.
Got it.
And that was a big part of Trotter's kitchen.
Okay.
That's good.
Yeah. So what kind of cooking do you, how do you do, what kind of cooking do you do there?
I just live in the world in which we live, right? Which we all live.
Yeah.
I try my best to write very vague, arbitrary menus.
Okay.
That leave a lot of room for opportunities that the field is literally giving us today.
Okay.
So with what we've got, we have.
Yeah.
Right. And it's a walk through the garden. It's a walk through the woods.
Yeah.
It's a walk through the greenhouse. And it's a lot of walk. You walk a lot, right? 6 miles a day.
I feel like you're mocking. I feel like you've been mocking me since I told you I went for a run yesterday.
No, not at all. You walk a lot.
Well, I don't know. Yes, I do. But as you're saying it, you're fighting back the desire to laugh. So well, I take it that is mocking.
Okay.
We have an audience here. Everyone knows what I'm talking about.
You run a little. Is that right?
Oh, that's what it was. You thought that me saying I ran 6 miles was like that just seemed like a pittance.
Not at all.
Okay.
I can't touch this. That's right, mile jog. That would kill me.
Okay.
But a walk through the garden, we do every day. And it really hopefully starts the day and it starts the, you know, everything.
Yeah.
It's everything. So,
okay. Let's look at this event. Let's look at this event we just did, right? Mm-hmm. So we did an 80s dinner. Not we. You guys did an 80s dinner. We had two. There were two guest chefs. So David Waltuck from Chanterelle was here. He did a canapé and he did a duck course. Claudia Fleming, who used to be probably best known from Gramercy Tavern, was here. And Claudia did dessert. And then you hit the books. You researched a bunch of chefs, and you did a Jean-Louis Paladin dish. You did an Alice Waters inspired dish, and you guys did a Southwestern dish. Now, obviously, part of the mission with all this is to incorporate, show off, give people a taste of stuff that comes from the chef's garden. I mean, that's part of the goal, ideally.
Yeah.
But what's that like for you? So and this was in the course of a week. I don't know what it was. I know a week prior to this dinner, there was some huge event here. And then you developed these things over this week. And I know when we met you Friday night, you still had one piece of one of the dishes wasn't finalized. You were wondering about the sauce. On one of them, you were still like unresolved in your head a little bit.
Yeah.
But
how was the sauce?
It was delicious. Okay, good. But that's interesting. You know, it's almost like you live a pop-up lifestyle in a way, because you're exploring with regularity. There's no set menu there. It's not like every the nights you don't have a special event, there's a regular restaurant there. So what? It's interesting to me because I feel like, you know, it runs against the grain of what so many chefs are like, which is you want to have the signature dish. You want to have, you want it to be your own repertoire, right? But you seem very happy to be sort of constantly shifting, constantly innovating, constantly creating new stuff, some of which probably at least – In the foreseeable future, you're not going to serve again. A lot of stuff you do get served once.
Yeah, most of it.
How do you? It seems to me like you're uniquely suited to that. I'm wondering if you even understand what it is about yourself that makes that the case, because I think it's unusual. I think you and Lee are lucky to have each other.
Yeah, we don't. Happy birthday, Farmer Lee Jones. we don't latch on to, the idea of perfection. You know, I don't latch on to the idea where like you play the same song, you know.
So in culinary terms, you mean you don't latch into this notion that you have a dish, you kind of workshop it behind the scenes, it comes out, maybe right. you tweak it here and there, and then within a couple of months of its debut, it's kind of like could be there forever. Yeah.
And you know what? Like I love that environment as well. If we were in a different setting, maybe it would be the case, like more of a restaurant format. I think it would make more sense.
Yeah.
But because most of our events are very thematic, that have a very specific message or purpose, there's no reason to find a singular course that we get to repeat, unless it's like bread service or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't found that yet. So
there's not a signature chef's garden thing.
No,
that's part of like every event.
Right. There's a course title that we call a walk through the garden, you know, and it's still, I mean, it's completely different every day. It doesn't mean a salad. It's just whatever. It's just a way to get people, you know, on ease a little bit about buying into an event that they don't have a full scratched out menu for. You know what I mean?
Okay. So, you mean from the customer side or from the visiting chef side?
Right. The customer side.
Okay.
We sell the events like up to 3 months out and there's no menu yet.
Right.
You know?
Right.
We can write a basic, you know, framework of something that might make sense with the ingredients. But yeah, well, let's back up with the 80s thing for a second. Can we do that?
Yeah.
I think 2 years ago, I started the idea. I wanted to do an 80s dinner. I wanted to do an 80s dinner. And I apologize. My goal was to kind of make a mockery of the 80s.
Sure.
And
there's lots to mock.
It was a big, like dramatic, like tweels. And as Claudia Fleming said yesterday, like real architectural, you know, stuff.
She was talking about desserts that she personally felt absolutely zero identification with, had no interest in at the time or in looking back at them.
Correct. Yeah. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just felt like it would be a fun, like, random pop-up that people would just, like, have a lot of fun with.
Yes.
And then as I started looking into it, and you and I had a conversation, and Marcy Barker had a conversation.
You need to explain. She was like
the prior director.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I brought the idea by Marcy, and Marcy's like, no, what do you mean? Like, don't, you know, like, this is serious. You know, there was actually some really great chefs doing really great things, which I have completely fell in love with this time period, the idea. And as we've been working through for, you know, a year or two, just like reading books and kind of just getting a better understanding of that time period and what it meant to where we are today is so important. So connecting with you was probably the most important thing we could have done for this.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah. I appreciate that.
Yeah, it was great. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
So yeah, going into like different dishes and latching onto perfection, there's little bits and pieces that come with us along the way, right? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I really actually liked, you know, like in that, I really liked how the cactus like studded the sauce last night. I think that was interesting. I brought a new texture. Maybe it's a way to look at garnishing sauces in the future with cactus specifically or something. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, so there's little bits and pieces that it's a journey, right? It's an adventure, and we get to kind of bring memories of it along the way, and it influences us tomorrow, and the next day, and the next day, and we'll continue to change, and hopefully we get better at doing something we've never done before.
You mentioned not believing in perfection, right? I'm wondering if your musical background helps you with this. I just started taking guitar lessons. I've had two as we sit here today. I'll have had more by the time this airs if I don't smash my guitar in frustration. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was in my second lesson and I was trying to get these chords. I don't know how anybody – it's impossible. I'm going to work really hard. I don't know how – I'm going to learn chords. Like, they just seem impossible to me. I don't know if I've been alive too long and my fingers aren't just going to be able to be that nimble. But, you know, I kept messing one up the other day and I got really mad, you know, at myself. And the instructor goes, Adam goes, Andrew, the thing about music is you make a mistake, it's gone. Like, you can't look at it. You just got to chill out, you know? And musicians make mistakes all the time. They make mistakes on stage. Like, the best musicians in the world make mistakes. You don't see them, maybe. You don't hear them. They know they did them, and it's over. The minute it happens, it's over. And it seems to me like this is applicable to what you're talking about with food. I mean, you, by the nature of what you do, you're going to have, like, we did a dinner last night, 5 courses plus canapés, right? And you do that all the time with stuff that you developed within days or weeks of actually serving it. You're going to have balls and strikes, and you're going to have home runs, right?
Of course.
And you know what they are.
Yeah.
Have you learned to take all of it in stride? I mean, not that you don't look back and do a Monday morning, you know, do a postmortem and see what you can learn from it.
Yes.
But have you learned to accept the inevitability of an ebb and flow of your success rate?
Yeah. 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 Definitely. It's, you know, sometimes there are mistakes that can easily and have obviously been solved. And those are the ones that hurt the most.
That's the one you kick yourself for?
Those are the ones that really, you're like, come on, guys. Like, we've all done this before.
So right. We knew better than that.
We know this move.
Yeah. Right.
We played this song.
Right.
You know? And then there's other times where you're like, wow, I wasn't sure that the asparagus would or would not stick to the asparagus flan. Thank you, Jean-Louis Paladin, for not including that in your recipes, you know, or your cookies or whatever. You know, you don't know those things until you do them. And then it's guests are arriving in an hour. So,
right.
There are certainly things we learn along the way.
And
those are things you definitely, we talk about. We have our Tuesday meetings. They're not Mondays. And they are a recap and a
and who's in those meetings?
The entire team.
Which is how, I mean, we're going to talk to some of them here in a minute. But how, is that the, how, what's the entire team?
There's like 9 nine people. And the kitchen team is the four of us right now. There's three people cooking, and there's one guy behind the dish machine. And,
okay.
You know, we went almost 2 years without a dishwasher.
What?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Well, it actually works. It's not advised, but
you just use different plates for every course, and it all just gets stacked all night, or happens?
You work through it. You get your wait staff on it. You get your
during
your
service
cooks on it. Yeah, I mean, we weren't doing big dinners without a dishwasher, but we'd bring in guys from the farm to help and stuff like that. But,
wow.
Yeah, it was a pretty impressive time period, and we all learned a lot.
Uh huh. Dishwasher, people who aren't in the industry don't know. It's a really important job.
The most important guy. And I was really holding out. We'd bring people on, and he just wasn't right. So
yeah.
We wouldn't hire. And
yeah.
I finally found our guy.
Yeah.
And he is, an avid fisherman and an avid forager.
Yeah.
And he, a builder.
Yeah.
And he just comes in with beautiful mushrooms.
Yeah.
Or like fresh trout roe.
Yeah.
Or, you know, just he's our guy.
That's great.
Yeah. We're excited. Our team's strong.
You'll yeah.
In a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What else about this thing? What else about this sort of ebb and flow, constantly changing thing? It's interesting. You said you look at your job, your time here, by seasons. Mm-hmm. It seems to me to be of a piece with kind of being on a farm. But the nature that what you...
Completely.
Yeah, but that what you have to work with changes, but that doesn't necessarily flow into, and we're going to do all these events are going to be different, and you know what I mean? Like, and it's going to be this constant changing thing, but it does seem to me to be very harmonious with that, right? It seems to be that, like, if you're going to be like that, a farm would be the place to be that.
Right.
Yeah.
Was that a question?
Yeah.
Where was the question?
Well, the question is that accurate?
Yes.
And can you wax poetic on that for me?
Yeah, I mean, what does it mean? Okay.
I mean, you live on the farm. You yeah. you walk the ground. You see these changes. I mean, visitors come for a day or two.
Yeah,
it seems to me like your entire your biorhythms have got to be at this point like plugged into this living organ, this incredibly complex living organism, and that would seem to jibe with the way you go about your chef life.
Definitely. You know, it's June. It's, you know, for Junes are busy on the farm. It's time to move. You got to go on to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing and stay busy. In the winter, you know, it's a different kind of busy, but it's busy still. We hosted 680 guest chefs last year at the Culinary Vegetable Institute and the Chef's Garden.
Right? Yeah.
And this is purely for a way for people to get a better understanding of where their food comes from.
Mm-hmm. Right?
They want to come to learn. And I think that's important. But when you live and work out here, you get a different understanding of a carrot. You know, you get a different understanding of the cucumber and the rate at which they grow,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's a wonderful opportunity. It's just not. Imagine, like, I was trying to get into this a little bit ago. There's farmhouses, right, in the country mm-hmm. that, you know, raise a pig and make pickles and mm-hmm. live off of their land, and
mm-hmm.
but there's farmhouses globally that do that. Right? It's not just here. It's all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And in each one of these places, they do something just slightly uniquely different that also sustains them. When we look at preservation, or when we look at really living in the seasons, we look at these places as well and how they do it. Because if you could imagine, sauerkraut on a global view, right? Everybody's preserving cabbage in some
mm-hmm.
way. Which is cruciferous, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is cauliflower leaves and Brussels sprout leaves and broccoli leaves also, right? So where we're living with an essential abundance of something at some point, right? Because cauliflower, let's say, only makes up, 20% of the plant's mass.
Mm-hmm.
We're able to look at these ingredients and and consider a form of preservation that maybe someone else in the world is doing with the same family of ingredients. Some, you know, does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I don't know. I think that's what keeps us really busy is in preservation and working through the seasons and working through the farm as it continuously changes. For me, maple syrup is not a fall ingredient, right? You often see it served with like pumpkins and sweet potatoes, and you see maple syrup on like, you know, Christmas stuff and fall stuff. It's a spring ingredient.
Maple syrup?
Yes, early spring when it's freezing at night and it's thawing during the day. When sap is running, that's when the trees are tapped, and that's when the syrup gets cooked, right? It's not something that happens in the fall. It's not made in the fall. It's made in the spring, you know? Does that make sense to you?
It does. Is this a unique opinion? Are you blowing my mind? Is that what you're asking me?
I don't know. Like, I think it's an example of, like...
Well, yeah, I'm not going to... I mean, I would never argue it. But what to me, is this an opinion you feel like is unique to you? Is this an opinion that a lot of people who sort of understand agriculture and farming, you know, history and food history understand that? And it's just kind of somehow... through certain pieces of writing and this narrative everybody's kind of bought into, it's become, you know, like people think of nutmeg and allspice and all that stuff as autumn spices, mm-hmm. because it goes with pumpkin, right?
Yeah.
But the spices aren't autumn spices. They're always there. They're dried spices,
right?
Yeah. But most people wouldn't think of using that stuff in the spring.
I've never grown it, you know, I've never seen it, and I'm not really sure how that plant cycle works.
Sure.
My assumption is that most of those dried seeds and spices do happen in the winter.
Okay.
Naturally.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
They would dry through fall, and then you'd have them in the winter and into
spring.
That's interesting.
Like a whole rabbit hole we could go down.
Yeah.
Because,
you
know, there's this term now, pumpkin spice, right?
I don't even, yes.
Well, no, they use it for like lattes, and I don't.
Yeah, got it.
I mean, to me, a latte is milk and espresso, and see you later. But there's not like there's pumpkin in those drinks. It's because it's the spices that are associated with pumpkin. That's mm-hmm. what people mean by that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's autumnal,
right?
But the spring thing isn't the maple syrup thing is that's interesting.
It's the same
to me.
Thing. It's like with ham. It's like ham is not a. You know, really a fall ingredient. It's the fresh cuts that are fall ingredients. You kill a pig in the fall when it's cold outside.
Yeah.
You know, not because that's when it's fat, but because that's when it won't rot when you leave it outside and, you know, for a couple of days.
Sure.
And you eat the things that don't spoil, right?
Yeah.
In the fall, you eat the ribs and the other.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then you cure the hams. And
yeah.
That's later. You don't eat that stuff like in the fall.
You
eat that stuff in the spring. And so naturally, I think we've found, to answer your question, a really beautiful rhythm with the seasons. Right?
Mm-hmm.
A really natural that just sort of exists. Our pantry is fluid.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's always pushing and pulling, and there's shorts and longs, and when you're out, you're out, and that's the way it is.
And you're happy to kind of surf that.
I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you the other sort of I don't know what I would call it. I guess there's a word that I just can't think of because it's early on Sunday morning. But there's a sort of it's not a dichotomy, but there's a certain it's interesting to me that you seem to be happy to sort of like we just said, like ride that wave, right? But you also look, I've seen food you put up on Instagram, I've seen the stuff you put up here sometimes. I mean, you know, as I say in The Godfather, you're good with a knife. you're technically very accomplished. You're able to move amongst different kind of sort of styles. You got a great eye. I mean, your food can look beautiful when you want it to. That's usually stuff I associate with ego. But, you know, in this conversation and like when and watching you work and even the way you are with your crew, you seem to be kind of like largely unburdened by an ego. You know, it seems like you want to do beautiful stuff. You want it to be delicious. But you seem to be kind of happy to be almost like a steward of all these bigger things. Does that make sense?
A storyteller.
A storyteller.
Right. Like,
okay, what do you... So you've thought about this.
A little bit.
What does this mean to you?
I mean, it is interesting to me, like you took on, you know, one of the people you chose last night was Jean-Louis Paladin,
yeah,
who's one of the most accomplished chefs in the history of this country,
also
right?
A wonderful storyteller.
Yes. Yeah. Interesting. But it was interesting to me, like he was like the gold standard of his day, and you decided, oh, I'm going to do a Jean-Louis dish, you know? Like that takes a healthy some confidence, at least, to do it. But go ahead. What do you mean by that?
Well, if I like the line of unburdened by ego, but if our main function is, you know, for our audience is to give them a sense of time and place, right? Is to get them a better understanding of where they are in the season, and maybe there's these little moments of overlap that inspires a dish, right?
Mm-hmm.
And let's say we want to serve that and tell that story. Sometimes taking a real careful approach to how you present it is
mm-hmm.
important, you know,
mm-hmm.
and the way that those items align on the plate or the direction in which you can guide them to eat them or enjoy them is important, right? And
mm-hmm.
and we take a lot of care into that to really help tell that story.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it's, you know, about a moment in time. Sometimes it's a very specific, you know, group of plants that might be growing together and doing
mm-hmm.
interacting in an interesting way.
Or, mm-hmm.
you know, it doesn't matter. It's like just about the story. And presentation is important to do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
You only have like so many words you're allowed to put on a menu to tell a story.
Yeah, but I'm not even just talking. I mean, I brought up the presentation because I think that's often where ego is reflected, right? Because the food. Because it doesn't, it's not essential to how the food tastes, right? So that's always something that feels like a little, you know, unnecessary to me. It's been an ongoing conversation on this show in the last few months. I think it's much more important to men than it is to women, you know? I'm not just saying that because it's, yeah, I'm not just saying that because it's, you know, 2019 and it's like we're in this era of like guys are horrible. But, I do think that's a valid distinction. I do. I think it's a totally valid distinction. And I think it is about ego a lot of the time. But, you know, the food's also – it's your food's – I mean, it's delicious. That's the other thing. You're able to move around amongst these different styles mm-hmm. and kind of key into what – maybe that's also part of storytelling. You're able to key into what need – you know, which knobs, to put it in musical terms,
right?
Like which one needs more bass and which one needs more like you kind of seem to know how to amplify the right stuff. That to you all falls under storytelling.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. I mean, and I've had I think you're right. I think it is changing the culinary world a little bit when you I'm only in this headspace because for the last, you know, 7 days straight I've been in this, you know, time period.
Yes.
And where we are today.
Yes.
We've had a lot of conversations about it.
Yeah.
The world changes, moving fast, you know, and
yeah.
And I'm really excited to be a part of it.
Yeah.
You know, I've had women bosses my whole life.
Yeah.
In the industry too, so I don't see what I think a lot of people will see or talk about, you know.
What do you mean?
Well, like that, it was like, you know, the like really hard climb up, hard spots for women in the
yeah.
industry. There were more female line cooks in my home in Charleston than
yes.
there were men line cooks.
And, oh, okay. Yeah. So let me ask you this. Do you, having said everything we just said, do you have dishes that we would call like a signature dish?
The most.
Are there things like in your back pocket or in a notebook or that when you cook for friends or if you do a dinner just for like the you know, for people who are on the farm or for Lee and his family, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Is there a Jamie Simpson signature dish?
Yes. In the terms of music, I find it incredibly important and art to have a voice, your own voice.
Yeah.
Your own style.
Yeah.
Or something when people are able to look at something and let's say you're walking through a museum. And you see a painting
yeah.
and you don't know, maybe you've never seen the painting before, but you know exactly who painted it.
Yes.
Right. That's important. And it's really powerful. And you're on the radio and there's a Katy Perry song on.
Yes.
And you've never heard it before, but you know it's her. That's a voice. It's really important.
I heard a song a couple of months ago and I'm like, I know Meatloaf wrote this song.
Yeah.
And it was a woman singing it, and sure enough,
cool.
He had.
Wow.
But
exactly.
Yeah, that's your point.
That's
yeah.
a powerful,
yes.
powerful place
yes.
to be. That's something that I'm always pushing towards is that understanding when somebody can look at the plate and say, like, that was Culinary Vegetable Institute, that was Jamie Simpson, that was a time and place.
Yeah.
That's valuable. So we're working on a book right now.
Yes.
To do that. And we do have a lot of just very singular, I think, techniques that are ours, mm-hmm. you know, that we've worked really hard on and yeah. are kind of universal with different vegetables at different parts of their lives.
How you treat them. And yeah. Yeah. Can you say what one of them is, or do we have to wait for the book?
Yeah, just, I mean, you'll see. Yeah,
okay.
You'll see, there's a lot of things. There's like just different ways to, like, you know, you don't have to necessarily dice a potato. You know, like it doesn't have to be. There's a lot of different ways you can treat a vegetable, and I think you'll see. We are known, obviously, I think, for a couple of dishes that that people know, and they're pretty iconic. And
yes.
We're recognized by. But in the book, we're doing 200 recipes. We're going to really explore. There's 600 varieties of vegetables. Mm-hmm. More of, like, in some degree, a little bit of textbook, unusual vegetable entries. Mm-hmm. Just really detailed cataloging of different ingredients.
You're teaching people.
Yep.
Yeah.
And we have, we've selected some of these ingredients to apply recipes to. And then there's a third of it that's really telling stories and history from the chef's garden and where they've come along over the last 35 years.
Okay, so let me ask you the last question. It's kind of a follow-on to what we were just talking about. Then you may or may not have an answer to this, and if not, I'll just cut out the question. But, you know, you were just talking about hearing something and knowing it was, you know, written by someone or painted by someone. Mm-hmm. A lot of what you do here, it seems to me, I would call it channeling, right? It's like last night, you were channeling some of these people, you know, at least their dishes. Now, what's interesting to me is I heard this great interview years ago with Gene Wilder, right, the actor, and he was saying that his whole he did not buy into this notion of disappearing into a role entirely, right? Mm-hmm. So, and what he was saying was, like, when he was in the movie The Producers, right? His character, it was half that character and half Gene Wilder, right? And they merged, sure. right? And so when you see Gene Wilder, or I don't know if you ever saw any Gene Wilder movies, but, you know, Blazing Saddles, Silver Streak, all these movies where he was hilarious, you bought the character, but it was always him, right? In there, right? Sure. So what I'm wondering is, like, you do a dish, like last night you did an Alice Water style dish, a Jean-Louis style dish, a sort of Southwestern-y, John Sedler-y kind of dish. Is there always, like, a little kernel of, is there to you a recognizable flourish, something that's like a tell that Jamie Simpson put this dish together tonight?
No. Yeah. For me.
And what is it?
We're not trying to be like, you know, Alice Waters.
Right.
And what I mean by that is, like, read enough information to know that what was happening at that time was just grabbing on to what's in season now, right? Mm-hmm. Grabbing on to just very minimal interaction with or manipulation, right? And just simple processing and handling. And the storytelling really happens just through that approach, right?
Yep.
Same thing with Jean-Louis. It's like French technique with American ingredients. So I got that, right?
I
know how to, like, manage that and tell that story. And that was the goal. It wasn't trying to, like, you know, pull, you know, there was no recipes for these things, you know,
mm-hmm.
that we pulled out of and made. We mm-hmm. just latch on to the philosophy and get a better understanding of what message they're trying to tell and help deliver it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the goal.
Okay.
Hey, Andrew.
Yeah.
Thanks for this.
Thanks for sitting down, Jamie. I appreciate it. And thanks for being a pal over the last few years.
You need a refill?
It's always good to see you.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I cooked for your birthday once 1 year. What year was
Yeah, well,
that?
My birthday, I didn't know this because Lee's birthday is today, as we sit here on June 23rd. My birthday is June 24th.
Oh, tomorrow.
Tomorrow. And I came to the farm. The first time I ever came was for a what's that? What does that look?
I had no clue.
Yeah, well, it's not even on my Facebook page anymore. I don't like the Facebook birthday onslaught.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm good with like three or four friends texting me and go out to dinner with like my wife and another couple. I'm good. So there's no reason you would know it, but you did a, I have this blog called Tokeland, and you did like a toke.
Yeah.
It was like a toke with a candle underneath. It was like a,
yeah, a little birthday yeah. cake with, yeah. with a toke cloche.
Well, see, this is what I mean about you really having the goods more than I think. I think you often are happy to sort of subordinate it to the mission of any given day, but it's been apparent to me on my visits here that you're like a seriously terrific chef. Anyway, I'm glad to help more people know that.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you for everything.
This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believe comfort food can be just that. Know where your food comes from. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
Hey, are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Kathy Irway, and I'm the host of Eat Your Words here on HRN. Every week I sit down with food writers to talk about their newest work, from colorful cookbooks to food memoirs to exposés on the food industry. It's all meaty topic for discussion. You can find Eat Your Words wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to the show. I'm going to get you to part two of this week's episode in just a moment. But first, as always, you know, the only thing we ask of our listeners, and I'll keep asking this, a couple of you have stepped up in the last week or two. If you would take a moment to review our show at Apple's podcast store, or even just leave a rating, which is as easy as rating, you know, an Uber or a Lyft driver. You can just hit the number of stars you want to give us. If you have a little more time, a review would be much appreciated. I have pointed this out in the past. The reason I ask for that is not ego. It helps people find the show. For example, if you search just for the word chefs, I think a few weeks ago we were as high as number 11. Someone told me we come up a little higher than that these days. That's quite something for a show, you know, little scrappy show like this. And that is largely due to the engagement of our listeners. So that is why we ask for that. I would also encourage you, if you are on social media, the best place to keep up with the show, other than subscribing on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or your favorite podcast platform, is to follow us on Instagram. Our handle there is @chefpodcast. That's easy to remember, @chefpodcast. We do drop a post every time a new show goes up. And if you want, you can link from our bio to the new episode. So a little less efficient than simply subscribing, but if that's how you like to do it, have at it. Okay. With that, I want to introduce you to four people that I just came to really love. It's this little troop of people who are in the kitchen at the Culinary Vegetable Institute at the Chef's Garden working for Jamie Simpson. The team is Madison Maynard, Tristan Acevedo, Lincoln Marquis, and Kayla Jarvinen. And I hope I pronounced all of your names right, you guys. If I messed up, please forgive me. I looked up your last names online today, and I'm hopefully did it right. I did do my best. I did check one of them with Jamie. The other ones I thought I could handle. Anyway, these people have been at the restaurant for varying lengths of time. You'll hear their stories as we go through this interview. But it's this really, to me, just, gosh, can I say it's a lovable little quartet of people? I was only there for 2 days in June, but I really grew fond of this group. I loved their chemistry, both with themselves and with Jamie. They're all there for very different reasons. They're all there for very different lengths of time, but they all just feel this, I think, a pull. You know, several weeks ago we had Patrick O'Connell on the show, and he made this comment, which has become one of my favorite observations. It's very philosophical, but the line was that if you're very lucky, you will realize that there is a place in the universe where you belong. And I'm not going to say all these people will be there forever. I'm sure they probably won't. But, you know, I think Jamie has found that this happens to be his place. He's there for 6 years so far and counting. Tristan, who you'll meet, has been there for a couple of years. The others will tell you their own stories. But at this moment in time, this is where they all feel like they belong. And you'll get a sense, I think, of some people who are really enjoying a special chemistry with each other. And I should say, I feel like I'm waxing on and on and on about the Chef's Garden. The Chef's Garden is not a sponsor of this show. They're not paying me to say any of this stuff. I happen to really have a fondness for Jamie and Farmer Lee and the rest of the Jones family, and other people there like Mike, and you guys know who you are, Michelle, and various people I've met there over the years. So, with that, I'm going to turn it over to this part two of my Sunday morning in Milan, Ohio, a couple of weeks ago. I hope you enjoy it. I'm here with the kitchen team of the Culinary Vegetable Institute. And, you know, we were here for this event this weekend. So I should say, at the Culinary Vegetable Institute, there's the kitchen and the event space downstairs. And then upstairs, there's a very beautiful guest suite, which I did not stay in. Claudia Fleming stayed there. And David Waltuck and I were down in the guest quarters downstairs. But we had all been up watching some television up in Claudia's suite. And we came out at like 11 o'clock. David and I had to go to sleep Friday night. And the whole crew, I think, was still there breaking down maybe. But like it was like 11, 1130 at night. There hadn't been an event that night. And I said to David, I was like, God, this is like, these guys work like they're in a restaurant. Like, these are some serious hours here. And I said to Jamie, I said, you know, do you think people would be up for like a, just a quick round table? Cause I, you know, we're, it's not a restaurant really. I mean, some nights it becomes, I guess, a pop-up. But I just wanted to get a sense of kind of, you know, who the four of you are, how you got here, what you get out of it sort of. And like that was really all that this kind of all this was about. So first of all, can each of you just introduce yourselves, please?
My name is Madison Maynard.
Okay. And I have to interrupt. Sure. Madison spelled?
It's M-A-D-Y-S-E-N. It's okay. A little different.
Little different.
Yes.
Was that just to be different or is that a...
I think it was my dad's idea. Just the story I've heard is he didn't want the word son in his daughter's name. So
really?
Played around with that spelling a little bit.
Interesting. Okay.
That's where it came from.
So. Okay.
Yep.
Very good. Thank you.
I am Kayla Jarvinen. I've been with CVI for 6 months now.
Thank you.
Hi there. My name is Tristan Acevedo. I've been with the Culinary Vegetable Institute for a little over a couple years.
Lincoln Marquis. I'm actually a high school culinary arts instructor, but I come and hang out when I get a chance.
So, cool.
Virginia.
Okay. So here's the first question I want to ask. You know, when I brought this up to Jamie, probably the last time I would ask cooks to meet for an interview was on a Sunday morning before noon. Can you guys tell me what would you normally be doing if you weren't here today? Like right now?
Healing.
Well, I mean, I just started my summer, so I got a plenty big honey-do list, but and I live on a farm, so I have fun to do. But Sundays, a lot of times, are I enjoy now because it's kind of a time to be a regular person on the weekends.
So
I was in the industry for a long time.
Yeah,
and so Sundays were either brunch or healing, like my friend.
Okay, Kayla.
Yeah, sleeping, making breakfast. I like to make breakfast on Sunday mornings.
All right. Well, thanks for breaking away from that.
Probably some of the same. Just like to take a break on a day off and take it slow, get some stuff done, and nothing too exciting.
Got it. Okay. So am I right, Madison, you're here the least amount of time. You've been here how long? You were telling me on the drive over.
Yes, just shy of about 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Yeah, pretty new around here.
Yeah. And I know you and I talked in the car, but let's pretend for a second we did it. And you, what drew you here? And what's the first week or so been like?
Sure. So I am just finished my first semester of culinary school in Dallas. And I met Chef Jamie and Tristan at the Roots Conference in Dallas a few months ago. And I was really drawn to the event because of what a little bit I had read about their their values and what they're trying to do here. And then I was also inspired by what I actually saw and experienced working alongside them. So I just kind of ended up here. It worked out. Just hit them up about coming for a little bit this summer. And it's been great so far. It's every day is a new experience. It's very different from my experience I have working in a restaurant. Every day is something new, different. What they do is different every day, but it's also just different from my experience back home. So it's been great. Learning okay. a lot.
And can we say, I don't want to name names. I don't want to get you in any corporate hot water, but is it safe to say that you work in a restaurant that has a set menu? Mm-hmm. And we'll leave it at that. But it's a very polar opposite sort of reality.
Exactly.
Here yes. from there.
Yeah, that's okay. accurate.
Okay. Kayla, how about you? What drew you here? And well, let's just start with that.
Yeah, I have only been in culinary for 6 months now. This is the Culinary Vegetable Institute was my introduction to the culinary world. I applied as a dishwasher in December, and they were gracious enough to give me the opportunity to put my foot in the door, and here I am. I mean, it's been amazing. I haven't worked in an actual restaurant before.
Wow.
Back of house, I waitressed a little bit over mm-hmm. the past summer, but I mean, this experience has been incredible. The guys are so creative, and there's just like an open mind mentality.
Mm-hmm.
Every day that it's, I love it.
So you're from the area?
I'm from Michigan.
Oh, you're from Michigan. Yeah. So how'd you know about this place? What made you to get your feet wet in the business at a place that's so different? Like what drew you to here versus say, you know, like any other restaurant within a 400 mile radius?
I've been in the area for a few years now, and I actually was not aware of the Culinary Vegetable Institute as of 7 months ago. I stumbled across it, and
stumbled across it. You paid it a visit for an event or something, or you read about it?
I was looking for jobs online to get my foot in the door.
Yeah.
You know, some kind of a kitchen position, dishwasher, something like that. And I came across a job posting they had looking for a dishwasher, and I did some research on the facility, and it looked amazing. As Madison said, I loved their values. I loved what they stood for.
Yeah.
I loved, you know, their approach to cooking, and that's how I got started.
Great. Thank you. Tristan?
Yeah, I want to add really quickly before I get into my own history that Kayla touched briefly on how she got her foot in the door, because she doesn't realize that that's like a stroke of genius that most people don't utilize, but get your foot in the door any way you can.
Yeah.
She did it in the form of a dishwasher. And maybe she's a little shy about that, but that's something to absolutely be proud of. I think because she's so fresh in culinary, she doesn't realize that she's got a long legacy of great people that have done the same. So I found my way to the Institute because I also, like Madison, was seduced by Roots Conference, although the one that got me was the one in Ohio in 2015. I was working at a restaurant in Chicago at the time called Modo. But
oh, sure.
I vowed to come back because I fell in love with the space. It's like, you guys exist here like all the time. Yes, we're here every day of the year doing something. And I was like, this place is amazing, because it was a break from that line cooking that can be so dragging. And, you know, working and honing your skills as a craftsman is an incredible opportunity in a restaurant. But the creative freedom that comes with being in a space that changes so frequently,
yeah,
I think allows you to mature very quickly in other areas.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, the nature of what we do is such that every event is different.
Mm-hmm.
So we get a real grasp of the industry from the perspective of everybody that's involved with food. You know, we work with so many people. Some of them are restaurateurs. Some of them are, you know, large retail operations that happen to have established food service programs within them just because of the size of the company.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's private dinners for 12 people.
Right.
And to really grasp what food is in the world and how everyone has a role in it, right? It's not just like fine dining and here are 60 guests, 100 guests every night paying $300 for a tasting menu. you really humble yourself and you learn to appreciate that everyone's got a connection to food. But I think you can kind of lose if you're on the line and you develop, you know, maybe a minor elitist mentality of this is what food should be.
You know, it's funny, when I was interviewing Jamie, we were talking about this, you know, the unusual nature of the work here, because the fact that you're doing different events that have drastically different focuses and menus, and sometimes it's there's a guest chef and sometimes it's a theme. And, you know, I hadn't thought of it till you just started saying what you were saying, but, you know, I've talked to a lot of people who have done private chef jobs in their life. There is a similar dynamic, I think. And also, people have said to me that, like, when they, if they worked, now a lot of people get out of the business, out of the restaurant business to go to private chefing. It used to be the other way mostly. Like, you would get a private chef job as you were coming up. And a lot of people told me that they felt like working as a private chef, if they had an adventurous client, accelerated their evolution because they were doing so many different things. Because they were, you know, one night it was dinner for two, one night it was dinner for eight, one night the person felt like eating this. They were allowed to experiment if they had a really great situation. Similar?
Very much so. I think working in a restaurant, you get very good at very specific tasks, right? You might be the fastest person in the city at breaking down lobsters. You might be the fastest person at, you know, portioning like large cuts of meat and fashioning them into 2-ounce portions that earn stars. But you don't gain the perspective that you gain from that big picture view of dining as a whole.
Right? Yeah.
Like what food is to everybody else. So I think what you trade off when you switch roles like that is maybe you lose some speed or some efficiency with specific tasks.
Yeah.
But you gain the knowledge of what should you be putting on the plate in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
You get out of the bubble of like, okay, you know, everybody's serving this. I'm going to serve it, but I'm going to do it better. And you start to look towards the future and you start to look towards the past. And that's a luxury that I think you can only have when you're not occupied with a 50-item prep list every day.
Yeah. Right. You kind of break out of this thing. It's another thing I hadn't thought of before, but you break out of this. Like restaurants are, they have to be. It's largely a mercenary kind of situation, right? When you said if you may be the best at breaking down whatever, well, if you are, you're going to be, guess what? You're it, right? Because it helps the organism function more efficiently. And that is the right decision for that restaurant.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. So you broke out of that. Can I ask before we move on? You came here from Chicago.
Yes.
Big change in setting.
Very much so.
Yeah. Was that a big adjustment?
Certainly, but it wasn't one that was difficult. I think it was exactly what I was looking for at the time. As a cook, sometimes all you want is space and fresh air. And it's very much where the food scene is headed. So being inspired by all of these people that are sourcing their ingredients from local producers and, you know, doing wonderful things with them and just in the form of respecting them, it was absolutely natural, I think, to go to a place that was more rural than I'm used to. And kind of be in isolation for a bit.
Cool. Thank you. Lincoln?
Yes, sir.
What are you doing here, Pops?
Yeah. So, just for the record, for the radio audience, I'm 55 years old. I was in the industry for a long time. I went to apprenticeship. But I was an old apprentice. I was a 28-year-old apprentice. So I was pretty old. I have a degree in radio, television, and film, of course.
Okay.
Anyway, I got a grant from James Beard to come work study grant. It's the Jean-Louis Paladin work study grant to come work.
Oh, cool.
I hung out for a week a year ago, April.
Yeah.
During spring break.
Okay.
And I wasn't quite sure what I was going to because it's kind of hard to define. CBI is a difficult place to define from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got here, I was completely blown away. Well, and the first thing that struck me is who you're interviewing actually here are the out there. They're not going to be offended by this, but these are the Oompa Loompas, okay? Except that they're food waste Oompa Loompas.
You sure they're not going to be offended by that?
They're not.
The eyes don't lie, Lincoln.
No, here's what I'm saying.
I think you might be off the mark there.
The first time that Jamie took us through, he took us through his walk through the garden. It was Willy Wonka 24/7. I mean, the whole thing. And what he was showing me, it was like, try this, try this. And he was telling me stuff that I had no clue. I mean, his knowledge of the 600 products they have there at the Chef's Garden is pretty pretty incredible. And so his kitchen is set up to build and instill a culture and a paradigm that's vegetable forward, that's completely focused on reducing food waste. Mm-hmm. It's in line with what the future is going to be.
Yeah.
And so, and he has an understanding as a mentor to give people some freedom to do what they're doing.
Yeah.
And so he's building these really strong debris yards.
Yes.
That know how to fix stuff.
But what made you want to, what exactly is your role, first of all?
My role here?
Yeah.
Fanboy.
Okay.
I did have the opportunity a month ago to bring some of my students.
Okay. Yeah.
From Virginia.
Okay.
And we took them to get on the train, and we arrived at 4 a.m. and they came and picked it. Somebody from CBI came and picked us up.
Yeah.
And it changed their perspective on everything.
Yeah.
Just because they were able to hang out for a weekend and we did the asparagus dinner.
Okay.
And it was, I could see just from the way that they were after the first morning they were here, that had an impact on how they were looking at food, how they thought about culinary, how they thought kitchens should be.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, for me, that's, he is serving his guests and he's a really good marketer for what he's doing, but he's also building people.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to go and have the way that you have to think about how things are going to be now to go in the industry and change things.
Cool. Thank you. A lot of people, when they start off, say, oh, I just want to learn to cook, right? That's what you're supposed to say. But do you have a sense? Do you think you want to be a chef?
I do. I would like to be a chef. Yes.
And what's, you know, working at a place like this, right? You see a lot of different things, right? This is the thing that becomes more and more clear to me. I mean, first of all, you're in the presence of the farm. But second of all, again, the number of different types of events that go on here. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've only been here a week. But I know there was a big event the Saturday before this one.
We've had a couple events since I've been here. Mm-hmm.
Already. Yeah. Do you have a sense of what the effect of that might be in terms of as you think about what kind of chef you might want to be, what kind of food you might want to do? I mean, you're going to get exposed to, you know, I know people who've worked at Next in Chicago, which is Grant Achatz's restaurant where they change 3 times a year, mm-hmm. you know, and I know people who work there feel like, you know, you get the amount of exposure to things in like 2 years there that you would need like 8 years in any normal timeline, right? Do you get the sense that this is going to kind of be part of a similar effect at this place?
Absolutely. I think when I've done a lot in a search for what I want to do just in life. And I think this is where I've finally landed.
Mm-hmm.
So I've done a lot of exploration before. And when I actually started culinary school, I had what I thought was some sort of a vision kind of clear, just in the past like 6 months that's evolved already quite a bit. Through school and having a little bit of work experience. But to me, going to the Roots Conference, that was kind of like a refresher on through the school and work experience. That was the first thing that I felt like I got some hands-on experience with mm-hmm. some of the things that led me to be a chef. So getting to come here has been more in line with what I see myself doing in the future. And this is really the first experience that I've been able to hands-on learn from people who are doing that, who can point me in the right direction, show me how to get there,
mm-hmm.
and where my path might lead. Because this is definitely what inspires me to move forward as a future chef. And so this has been a great experience. And even in the 2 weeks being here, I've seen so many things and really just been exposed to a lot of different even viewpoints of what if you did this and maybe this would be more impactful, and just a lot of different ideas working with different people who are, I think, pretty like-minded and who have a lot more experience and can really weigh in on knowing what my goals are and how they think I might be able to reach them. So,
Kayla, what you mentioned, you know, you've done some, you said you did some waitressing before?
I did, yeah.
Was that just a job? I mean,
yeah, I actually traveled to Canada last summer and waitressed for 6 weeks while I was there, just to make some money on the side.
And it was sort of seeing the kitchen from like a slight remove, but like within the same
building day to day? Is that what drew you for the first time to it?
Sort of. It was a cool experience. I'd never worked in a restaurant before. It was a small place. Everybody was really close, very family type of atmosphere. I guess that was kind of like it kind of put the idea in my head a little bit. Mm-hmm. At that point, I still didn't really have any intention of, you know, getting into the culinary world, but it was definitely the first step.
Had you cooked much in your personal life?
A little bit, not a lot. I grew up baking, like with my grandma's.
Okay.
So that was a big part of my childhood.
Yeah.
But not so much cooking until the last couple of years. I've gotten into the health and wellness side of things.
Okay.
And that kind of sparked my passion for wanting to learn how to actually really cook.
Are you studying that in any official way, or you're reading about it and learning at the farm and
reading and taking advantage of the resources that the Culinary Vegetable Institute has?
Yeah.
And just learning on the job.
Great. Okay. Can you guys, whoever wants to start answering this is fine, but you know, it's funny. I didn't know this till we sat down that Jamie was in a traveling band for a while. I feel like a lot of times the best kitchens function the way bands, I've never been in a band, but you know, there's a lot of nonverbal communication. There's an ability to sort of, you know, during a service, if you really know each other well, you can tell almost just with a look if someone needs some help, if someone needs you to do something very specific, you can anticipate something. You can, you know, can you all just speak to the chemistry of this team? I mean, you guys have been here drastically different lengths of time. I guess, Tristan, maybe I should start this with you. You've been through a couple, you've been through like three Avenger movies, right? Like you've been through a couple of different like permutations. You know, you've seen the different assemblages of people in the kitchen over a couple of years, right?
Right.
So can you speak, what are the constants and what changes?
I think constants is, at least for short periods of time, there is a team sport dynamic, which I think more people can relate to than perhaps a band.
Mm-hmm.
We can all conceptualize what a band might be like, but I can't personally relate. I can only hypothesize.
Team sports comes up a lot on this show.
Yeah.
That background. Yeah.
Team sports is relatable. Anyone that's ever, tried to, score against an opposing team with a bunch of comrades is pretty much what we try to do every night. We try to take what we do it as well as we can.
Yeah.
And succeed with it. But as far as the constants between the organizations, I think at least for short periods of time, everybody has had that. I think the differentiating piece is how you go about achieving that, and that determines the sustainability of the organization. So if you do it through collaboration and you do it through education, providing value to those that work, not for you, but with you, then you have retention. I think if you go about it in the fashion of fear and intimidation, for short windows of time, you can find collaboration, but it's not collaboration that's inspired. It's collaboration that's out of defense. And so what I noticed different, particularly about this organization, is that those that work with me try to provide value to me by allowing me to pursue what I wish to pursue, by allowing me to further my education in the kitchen, and by allowing me creative freedom. And so I try to do the same with those that work with me in the kitchen. Right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you want to learn? Let's talk about how we can go about learning that. I'm not necessarily the subject matter expert, but I can point you in some directions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a differentiating piece between a successful team dynamic, at least that I've seen thus far, and something that is so volatile that, 1 year you might find yourself at the top of the list and the next year you might find yourself running out of employees.
Right. Yeah. It's funny. Years ago, I interviewed Marcus Samuelson and he basically said he worked in a Swiss restaurant, Michelin star. I don't know if they had three, and his whole thing was like, basically your entire goal every day was not to screw up. It was the fear of screwing up. Like that was the motivator. It wasn't that you were driving toward success or toward full flight. You just wanted to not mess up and not get chewed out, and how crushing that was as a long-term proposition.
Absolutely. I think we live in a time currently where people have options, right? If you want to learn something, you have a world of knowledge out there, and you have access to it. You don't just have to go to so-and-so to learn one thing.
Yeah.
It's a more competitive market. And so because of that, you need to treat your employees with more respect than you've historically needed to.
Is there, we have limited time today because I gotta make a plane. But well, first of all, I have to ask: is there a conventional structure in this kitchen in terms of like, is there a hierarchy in this kitchen? Like, are you a sous chef? Or are you all how are you all defined, if at all?
I think if someone that's a guest always asks me. I always say I'm a cook, but in the kitchen, I think we respect each other enough to refer to each other as chef.
And that's it. There's no official breakdown of right. So you're here with a couple of years in the kitchen. Madison's here less than 2 weeks there. You guys are colleagues and chefs together.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a structure that naturally I think falls with experience.
Sure.
But I think we all respect each other enough as people to know that in a certain situation, someone else might be better suited to the task.
Yeah.
And at managing the task. And so with most cases, because I've been here longer, I'll be giving direction and receiving direction from Jamie or from someone else. But
that just happens organically. That's not like a regimented sort of right. thing.
It's not the traditional yes chef, no chef,
right.
no chef.
Got it. Kayla, you look like you wanted to jump in.
Just kind of echoing what he said, there's a mutual respect, I think, among all of us. And you know, you defer to, you know, those who have more experience than you. And, it flows nicely.
Yeah, but again, but it seems like, no pun intended, it's very organic. It just kind of happens. Lincoln, I'll give you 1 second. I just want to ask, because you're so new to it, what's this been like for you in terms of your... you know, your indoctrination into this kitchen, does that make a difference to you from other places you've observed or from what you even expected from a kitchen?
Sure. Sorry, are you asking if it's just different?
Well, I'm just asking that's a very unusual answer to that question. It's very, I mean, people are mm-hmm. so consumed with titles. You know, no, I'm not a sous chef. I'm an executive sous chef. Mm-hmm. Like that's something a person will say to you with a straight face. The goal is to put out good food. The goal mm-hmm. as Tristan was saying, ideally is in 2019 is to have a setting where you have a certain level of professionalism and ambition, but within a humane mm-hmm. construct, right? So I'm just wondering for you, if coming into this as a new team member, mm-hmm. if that was surprising to you, because the classic idea, even today in a kitchen, you know, you may not get barked at the way you used to. You may not have a saute pan thrown at you. But the idea is if you're the new kid in the kitchen, mm-hmm. you're getting all the grunt work. You're going to get probably treated not all that great. Everything flows downhill. Did you perceive it differently from the way you've experienced or imagined other kitchens?
Mm-hmm. I would say where I work is not a traditional. We don't have that traditional. I mean, there is more specific structure, but it's not a
it's not chef, like a French no brigade
right,
system
exactly.
Yeah,
so I haven't really been exposed to that. I think I probably was expecting that a little bit more here, just from what I knew about it. That's what I was a little bit expecting, so that was a bit of a surprise that it just kind of flows. It's a natural, like Kayla said, you defer to who has more experience. Like, I have a problem, I'll try to solve it. If I can't, who would I naturally look to?
Right.
You know? And yes, to be coming in and treated as, I guess, just valued, like my opinion and bringing the little experience I do have, that was valued. I don't have any experience to like deserve some sort of.
Let me ask you a very concrete question that I think will be very telling, okay? A lot of people go into a kitchen, they do not want to ask questions. They do not want to show that weakness in a kitchen. Mm-hmm. Did you have any hesitancy coming in to ask questions of the other team members there?
I've, I am definitely an over-asker, just as like a personality. Mm-hmm. But I also, I think that maybe speaks to my, I think I was nervous. Like, I felt like I would like to know more that I don't have to ask some mm-hmm. questions. But I think I ask a fair amount of questions. Tristan can answer that probably.
Did that question make sense, Tristan? Did you know what I meant by that?
Do you
disagree with the premise?
Not entirely. I think maybe I'm misunderstanding, but if the question is one of, is the environment intimidating in a way that you prefer to just keep quiet and do your job? Or is it one where you're...
Almost, but I guess more like as coming in as a new person that you don't want to stand out by showing what you don't know. Yeah, I think people don't want to be conspicuous as a new employee in most kitchens. I think that's seen as a sign of, you know, being green, a sign of not being able to pull your weight, a sign maybe you're going to be a little bit of a drag on the team. I think that's, I mean, I've heard that from a lot of people.
I cannot know how accurate this is, but my suspicion is that is changing with the times. I think
across the board.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good.
That are working for you now as cooks or as servers or whatever.
Yeah.
Are asking more of their employers in the form of knowledge.
Mm.
And so I think as a whole, I know because I'm part of it.
Yeah.
We're guilty of asking more questions and being more provocative and expecting more in the form of education.
Yeah.
And I think has historically happened. So
thank you. Yeah. Well, and it's also, I mean, we've been talking about this a lot on the show. It comes up a lot. It just at a bottom line level, it's a cook's market today.
It is.
It used to be a chef's market. There used to be like in any major city, maybe 10, 15, like, places that were thought of as important, groundbreaking. That's where everyone wanted to go. The restaurants had their pick of the employees. Right now, you see like major restaurants on Instagram saying like we're hiring sous chefs. There's a shortage. There's a shortage, and so cooks kind of can demand a certain culture, or they're not going to stay there.
Right.
Yeah. All right. We have very little time. Lincoln, you wanted to say something?
One thing I wanted to say as from my perspective, being on the brigade, I've been in the brigade, I've seen the whole thing, and on the outside, is that there is not a brigade structure per se, but it's a really more related to your Avengers metaphor, actually. You're looking at people that are going to work together and what they're good at, they're going to do.
Yeah.
But they're also going to work together and ask questions. And the part of the whole mission is for everyone to kind of learn as we go along.
Right.
So you're given empowerment and you're held accountable. This is like my dream class. If I had mm-hmm. a dream culinary school, it would be like they have here.
Cool. Okay, so last question for everybody. Well, first of all, I have to say one thing. Yeah, please. No, it's not my time. I just got to make a plane. But go ahead.
I think I want to be clear that we can differentiate that doesn't make sense for every organization. I think we have the privilege of functioning like that because we're in a remote space without the daily pressures of service. And we've been fortunate to hire for character. We've been quite selective. There are a lot of people that pass through these doors, but very few that stay for a long time.
Yeah.
So that doesn't work if you're necessarily a restaurant.
Yes.
Trying to manage cooks.
Yes.
But it does work if you're a creative space that's trying to get somewhere into the future.
Cool. Okay. First of all, I was going to ask about it. We don't have time to really talk about it, but the staff meal Friday night was amazing. Is that a normal staff meal? Was that like a guest staff meal? Oh. That Mexican dinner?
Oh, that was, kind of both. I think
that was pretty awesome.
You know, I don't want to get shot down for this, but we don't regularly do the staff meal like everyone else does. So when we do it, it's quite nice.
Oh my God, it was great. Anyway, here's what I was going to ask. I think, you know, I mean, Tristan, you're here from Chicago. Madison, you're here from Texas for a limited time. Kayla, you're kind of, you know, you're in the area, generally speaking, wanted to get into a kit, but not the most obvious choice. Can you all just speak for one moment to being open, I think, to a different path, right? I think there's so much heat now on certain, you know, there's this myth that the whole celebrity chef culture is dying. I think it's just morphed, you know. I think it's now like the people who are on Chef's Table and the people in the great, you know, these are great shows. They have a lot of value. But I don't think it's an obvious choice to come out to the Culinary Vegetable Institute. I'm not asking you to pump up the Culinary Vegetable Institute, but I think the notion of coming to a place that's not, you know, in a big city, that's not,
you know, the focus of these television shows, and what it is you think that opened you up to doing that? Is it a particular mindset? Was it just listening to a, you know, like you were at the Roots conference and there was a spark and you listened to that? I don't think it's the most obvious choice for people. And I'd just love for you to comment on this as like a, as a, as a part of one's self, design curriculum, which is what I think most careers are in this profession. And I'm going to here, I'm going to give everyone a mic.
I would say for me, well, first of all, I love to travel, so I'm not really attached to any one place in particular. So I think I was very open, to the idea of going somewhere different. I don't need to stay in Dallas right now. I don't need to be somewhere specific. My goal right now is really just to learn as much as I can, to learn how to do what I would like to do. When I met Jamie and Tristan at the Roots conference, like you said, that it was just like an instant click. Like months prior to that, I had a vision. I started school, was working, and I felt like that was kind of lost. And in those few hours that I worked with them, it all came back. And I felt like this is exactly what I want to be doing. These are the kind of people I want to be working with. And I've been missing that. And so I just kind of chased after that. And that's the kind of experience. I'm more interested in experiences than necessarily a place or a specific person. Like, it's about the experience and it's about the learning. And that's what I was expecting here. And that's what I found.
You know, like I said, I've been in the area for a little while now, but my plan when I first joined the CVI team was actually to potentially go to a culinary school in New York. That was what I was looking at. But as you know, as the weeks and the months went by, and we have so many like amazing chefs come to the Culinary Vegetable Institute for dinners and pop-ups and that kind of thing. And, you know, talking to people and getting their opinion and their, a little bit of their experience and stuff like that. CVI is just, there's no better place to be for me right now. You know, like I said, it's a very like open-minded, learning environment, and everyone is very willing to teach, and allow you to make mistakes as long as you're willing to, you know, correct them and you're making an effort. For me, there's just, like I said, there's no better place to be.
I fell in love, and, you know, I think really part of what continues to draw me to cooking that drew me initially was that cooking has the capacity to be an intellectually stimulating activity, one that's full of social responsibility and just saturated with color and vibrancy. And I've never to date found a place where I can exercise that more than here. I'm still here and I'm loving it, right? Every second of it.
That's great. Thank you. Lincoln, I just didn't include you because you're, huh?
I'm an old man.
No, I wasn't going to put it that way, but moral of the story, you guys agree, is something grabs you, something feels like the right thing. If you can do it, if you can afford to do it, whether it's through time, money, whatever it is, it's probably worth listening to. Yeah, it seems like you all feel hugely validated in making what's not probably for most people the most obvious decision.
I think that's accurate. I think we all have enough confidence, probably in ourselves, hopefully not to a fault, that this decision feels like a happy one. And,
yeah.
And the day-to-day is always, fulfilling of that question, right?
Yeah.
We don't wonder every day, like, oh my God, am I making the right choice? The way you sometimes do on a line.
Yeah.
And you're like, God, how much longer can I keep doing this?
Right.
I think every day we fall deeper in love with it, and we're like, this is absolutely what I should be doing.
Great. All right. Well, with that, thank you all very much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much, Andrew.
And hopefully we'll see you all again. Thanks. Thanks for coming in on a Sunday. And that's our show for this week. A huge thanks to Jamie Simpson, Madison Maynard, Tristan Acevedo,
Lincoln Marquis and Kayla Jarvinen. It was great being with you guys for a couple of days. It was great doing a dinner with you all. And I say doing a dinner, I'm the one person who wasn't cooking, but you know what I mean. I think we all had a great time together. Thank you for supporting me. To our engineer, Jeet Paul. Jeet, thank you, as always, for splicing these things together. To the rest of the gang at Heritage, thank you for your support. And to all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening, and we will see you back here soon on Andrew Talks to Chefs.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.